This is Dennis Anyone with Dennis Hensley. It's a podcast about making things up and making things happen. I love talking to creative people, and today my guest is Brian Sloan. He is the writer-director of the gay rom-com classic, I Think I Do, which is celebrating its 25th anniversary and is coming out in a 4K restoration on April 19th on Amazon and Apple. It will be available for streaming. It hasn't been up until now. There's also going to be an event a few days before that as part of Newfest, an in-person screening with a lot of the cast in attendance. And the cast is wonderful. It's Alexis Arquette. It is Tuck Watkins. It is Guillermo Diaz, like people that went on to do big things afterwards. It's just a really winning rom-com. I remember the Partridge Family songs are throughout it. And so it was so fun to talk to Brian about how this restoration came together. But before we get to the interview, I want to remind you that this podcast, Dennis Anyone, is brought to you by me. I do it because I love it. But if you enjoy it and want to support it, there are two ways you can do that. You can go to DennisAnyone.net and you can leave a tip in my virtual tip jar. Help me cover my expenses. I always appreciate that. Or you could become a subscriber to DNR Studios. I'm part of a group of shows in the Derek and Romaine family. And for a monthly subscription, you get my show early and you get all these other terrific shows. And you can learn about that at DNRstudios.com. All right, that's enough of the plugs. Here now is the interview with Brian Sloan. Joining me now from New York, it's Brian Sloan. He's the director and the writer of I Think I Do, a classic gay rom-com that's getting a restored version and all this fun stuff. So welcome to the podcast, Brian.
Thanks, Dennis. Good to talk to you today.
I remember seeing it for the first time. Did it play Outfest? I feel like it did.
It did play Outfest. It was the opening night film at Outfest in 1997.
Oh, I remember it. I remember seeing it. I remember loving it. I remember the Partridge Family songs because I am a Partridge Family fan, which we will get into. Does it feel like it's been that long or does it feel like it's flown by?
It definitely does not feel like it's been that long. 25 years just seems like such an enormous amount of time. And it just sort of, it does kind of surprise me that it has been that long. And I remember last year when we first started talking about this, it was the 25th anniversary of the release, which was April of 1998. That's when we first got the film out commercially. That's when we started talking about like, oh, we should really try to bring this back for the 25th anniversary. And I just was like, wow, 25 years. It's hard to imagine that it goes by like that.
Well, I want to know what the restoration involved, but first, why don't you say a little bit about the plot of the movie for people that haven't seen it?
Oh, sure. It's sort of like, I like to call it like a kind of gay screwball comedy. It's about a gay couple attending a straight couple's wedding. And over the course of this kind of wacky wedding weekend, he ends up meeting his ex-roommate from college, who he still kind of harbors a crush on. And then things get complicated, as they say. But all is good in the end. It all works out.
Do you remember what your initial inspirations were? What inspired you to write it initially?
Actually, it was funny. It was two different things. I was working on two very different projects. I started writing this after I finished film school. I had done like a short film called Pool Days, which did festivals and then was part of Boys Life with Strand Releasing. And so people were asking me like what I wanted to do next. And so I was working on one thing, which was sort of about a soap opera star in New York who's gay, but is being forced into a marriage by his manager. That was one project. And the other project was this, story about a group of college friends living together in kind of a group house. And it was sort of a, story about these different relationships and people falling in and out of love and, that sort of thing. And I was not having luck with either of these. but was still kind of working on them. And I went to one of my college friends' wedding, I guess, in the summer. And on my way back from the wedding, and the wedding was really fun. Like, it was just a great time seeing everyone again. And there was lots of, people hooking up with random people. And, these things happen at a wedding when you're in your 20s. Things can get a little crazy. So on my way home, I was just like, oh, maybe doing this kind of like college story, but setting it at a wedding would make it more interesting, and maybe just throw the soap guy into the wedding formula too. And that's sort of where it all kind of started to come together. I sort of took these two ideas that seemed very separate and kind of just melded them together. And that's where the idea kind of, that's where it really started.
It's such an interesting thing to look at the difference in the times that we're in compared to when that was made. Because back then it felt harder to get something out in the world. You didn't have the internet quite as, you know, you didn't have all of those options, or I could just make it myself on my phone and put it up there. But it also felt like a movie, once you got it made, it could have more of a life in theaters. And it just feels like things have kind of flip-flopped and all of that. Talk to me about your cast. They're kind of amazing. You have Alexis Arquette, Tuck Watkins, Guillermo Diaz. What do you remember about the casting process when you were making it originally?
I do remember the casting process was very, very long. We definitely had a lot of trouble casting this movie, and that was because of the era that we were in. This was still a time period where if you were trying to get a male actor to play gay in a film, whether it was an indie film, a studio film, it was really difficult. And it was especially difficult to get younger actors actually to do this. And it wasn't because younger actors didn't want to do it. It was because their agents, managers, handlers, that was considered career suicide. So we really went through a process of trying to get people to do this. And a lot of people, just said no. And it was just a real difficult, long. We spent almost 6 months casting this film, which is very unusual for like an indie film. You usually, maybe spend a couple months on something like this. But we really had trouble getting this cast together. But in some ways, the fact that it took so long, it did end up getting us like the right people. And I think we really got a magical combination in the end. And that was because of the length of the process as well. So I can't really complain in retrospect, though at the time it was really, really hard.
Well, I feel like reps back then would literally throw themselves between the camera and their client to keep them from being in a gay movie. They would jump off of buildings. They would do anything. There was a desperation around it. Like, don't you dare.
Yeah. The funniest, the lead actor in our film, Christian Malin, who played opposite of Alexis, that was the hardest part to cast. We cast Alexis fairly early. He was obviously very game to do something like this. That was a very openly queer role. But the other romantic lead opposite him was really hard. So anyway, Christian actually came into the casting office on our very last day of casting for that role. And the only reason he was there is he was a messenger, a bike messenger. And he was dropping something off in the office, and he saw a friend of his, and they said, you should go in for this movie they've been trying to cast. And he walks into the casting room, and the casting director says, Christian, what are you doing here? Your agent passed on this months ago. And he's like, I've never even heard about this movie. So his agent definitely, saw what it was, saw that it was a gay role, and just said no. And
threw their body in between Christian and the script.
Exactly.
Maybe lit it on fire. He, I think, was the biggest revelation for me going back and watching it. He's wonderful.
And he was so great in the movie. Just really amazing.
I think he and Alexis Arquette have maybe the best train station rom-com scene I can think of. Like at the end, the rom-com scene end where the person finally catches up with the other person. It's wonderful, that scene. What do you remember about shooting that scene in the train station?
That was our very, very last day of shooting. And I definitely remember it was a little bit harried and a little crazy because we were really shooting in a public space. We did not have like a typical lockdown, what they call lockdown on the location. The deal that we got to shoot there was that we could kind of be in a corner of the station, but people were going to be walking through and everything was going to be happening.
Right. They were going to shut down the train station for you.
Yeah, they were not going to shut down.
You're not Oprah.
No. Yeah.
At Barney's or whatever.
Yeah. So it was definitely, it was a little complicated to kind of get, what's a very emotional scene in that very public space. But both of them just did such an incredible job. And we really, I just really have to give it to the actors because they really focused. They were prepared. They really knew, how to make this work. And it really is, you know, definitely one of my favorite scenes in the film.
Oh, it's so good. The emotion is right there. Their chemistry is so strong. Christian is so great. He has what I like to call a secret amazing body, where his character doesn't have to have an amazing body. Like, it's not part of the story. And yet, yet when the shirt comes off, you're like, oh my gosh, I didn't count on that. All right.
Yeah. It's a surprise.
It's a bit of a surprise. I also was struck by things that you might not see now. Like the character played by, is it Maddie Corman?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. She smokes a lot. And I was like, oh, it's so weird to see people smoking where it's not like a part of the story, or it's just like, oh yeah, people used to smoke a lot at weddings and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was just, it's something that struck me.
Well, it's funny, when I screened the film in DC at the, you know, film festival in Washington, that's where I grew up. My parents came to that screening. And after the movie, I was like, oh, what did you think? And my mom said, oh, there was a lot of like smoking in the movie.
that was your mom's big note.
Yeah, that was her big note. She was like, oh, it didn't really, you know, the gay sex scene didn't bother her so much. But the smoking, yes, definitely bothered her. Because there is, you know, I definitely, and that's intentional too. I was sort of hearkening back to kind of like the screwball era as well. Like in those movies from like the 30s and 40s, people are obviously smoking a lot. So it was sort of meant to kind of echo that. But also it did reflect the times. I mean, people were still smoking a lot back in the 90s for sure.
Yeah. And Tuck Watkins plays your soap star. Perfect casting.
Yes.
He's such a good actor. I've seen him on stage and obviously in other projects since then. Boys in the Band, I think he was my favorite in that movie. And like, he's kind of like, sometimes when you feel like he gets to really act in a movie, he's like, I'm going to nail this to the wall so that people can't say that I'm just a pretty face, because I am really a pretty face too, because we all have eyes. But like, he's just so good, and he looks like a soap hunk in your movie. So talk about when he came in and what you remember about working with him.
When he came in, he was a soap hunk. I mean, he was on One Life to Live, or as he liked to call it, One Line to Learn. and he was a true soap guy. And the funny thing with that part, we saw a lot of people actually who were on soaps for that role. And the thing that stood out with him was the soap actors would come in to read the scenes, you know, for this film. And they would take it very, very seriously because they thought, oh, this is an indie film. Like, this is like serious.
This is my chance to really show my chops.
Exactly. This is my chance to kind of break out and show I'm a quote unquote dramatic actor. But Tuck really understood this was a comic role. And he was the one person who came in and read that role and just made it funny. You know, like he just was like, we were dying in the room, like laughing with stuff he was just adding and the ways he was kind of spinning the lines. And he wasn't taking it like very seriously, which was definitely the point.
I love Tuck also because he'd been out in his career for a long time. Was he out when you guys made this, or was that even something that was talked about? Such a different time.
Yeah, it was a very different time. It was definitely not something, you know, he talked about or we talked about. I think we sort of understood that was the case. But in terms of doing press for the movie, I don't think that's something he talked about, if I'm remembering right. But yeah, again, it was a different time. I mean, Alexis was definitely very out, you know, and definitely in the press for the film, you know, which he did a lot of. He really did talk about that. But yeah, at that time, it was like, you know, it was a very different environment where people were not supposed to talk about that. It was like not something you wanted out there. And, you know, again, agents, managers were like, do not discuss this if you're doing any press.
Well, I used to do a lot of writing for the gay press, the Gay Advocate, Out, and there were often straight actors that would be on the covers and you would have to enter them. And it was this whole song and dance around whether you ask the question or you don't ask the question, or I don't, it was just, everyone was like sort of trying to thread some imaginary needle. So I'm glad we're in a different era now. And it was because of films like that and other projects and just like one step at a time, like getting to where we are now.
It's a long process for sure.
Guillermo Diaz is in your movie and looks 11. Yeah. He's so adorable. What do you remember about Guillermo back then?
I actually met Guillermo because of Party Girl. Some friends of mine worked on the movie Party Girl. Parker was a friend of mine, and I knew some people on the crew. So I went to like the cast party for that show. And I met him there. And then I saw the movie and I was like, oh my God, Guillermo is just so funny and so great in Party Girl, kind of like was stealing scenes. And so I always had him in mind for this movie. I didn't know exactly which character. And I think when he came in to read, he read for a few different characters. But, you know, the character of Eric was definitely where the sweet spot was for him. He just really made so much fun with that part and was just so, you know, great. He was one of the people, you know, the first time he came in, he left, you know, the audition, we're all like, yeah, that's sort of it, you know.
And all of your actors went on to do more. And like, it was really one of those casts where you're like, oh, I know them from this and this and this and this. Did you stay in touch with a lot of them, or what was it like to watch them kind of go in their different directions and some achieve a lot of success?
Yeah. I mean, I've kept in touch with like Tuck and Guillermo, Maddie, you know, I've definitely, you know, I saw Tuck when he was doing Boys in the Band here in New York. And I did an interview with him for another outlet, which was really fun. It's always great to interview your friends and people you've known for a long time. So yeah, it's really been great to see the cast kind of keep doing stuff. I haven't really kept in touch with Lauren a lot. And I remember last summer I went to see the Spider-Man, you know, Into the Spider-Verse movie. And I'm watching this movie and I'm like, this voice sounds really familiar. And then I realized Lauren was Spider-Man's mom.
Right.
In Spider-Verse. And I was like, oh my God, that's so amazing that she's now, you know, playing like this really cool mom in such a really amazing film too. I'm not a huge superhero fan, but the Spider-Verse movies were really, really fun.
Well, it's also interesting. At one point, somebody says, oh, maybe we could have a gay wedding. Or like the idea of a gay wedding sort of seemed like a far-fetched notion that would never happen. And now, Now there's marriage equality. There's gay weddings all the time. What was your thinking about the idea of a gay wedding back then? Do you even remember?
Yeah, I mean, the idea really was to kind of present this idea of a gay wedding as not a big deal, kind of take it for granted that that's sort of what's going on and that's what these characters want.
Right.
Obviously I knew it was not legal at the time, but I really just felt for the story, I just wanted to present that as like, this is a normal thing. And the whole idea too of the movie, and this kind of came from that college idea that I started with, was sort of putting both the gay couples and the straight couples on equal footing.
Right.
You know, like really showing people like these, you know, couples and these relationships are very similar. It's, you know, the same issues with the straight couple as with a gay couple. You know, it's sort of like that's the equality just in seeing them together, seeing that they both kind of want the same thing. And that was really like this sort of secret, the secret political agenda behind the film, which definitely was something I thought about. You know, the reason it's set in Washington is definitely because of that, the big kind of talk that Tuck has with Jamie about getting married happens on the steps of the Jefferson Memorial. And that was sort of intentional. So there is this sort of like political, you know, subtext to the film, which is about, you know, equality. Like, why can't there be gay marriage? Why can't it be the same for a gay couple as it is for a straight couple?
Oh, I just noticed this thing I wrote on my pad when I was taking notes during the movie. I love that Tuck's big revelation is that he actually told his boyfriend his real age, which for an actor is like, I told you my real age. Like, that made me laugh out loud. What struck you when you went back and looked at it? What were the moments where you're like, oh, wow. What did you feel?
You know, I think the thing, Tuck's performance still makes me laugh. And this is, you know, I've obviously seen this movie, I don't even know how many times. And Tuck just constantly cracks me up with some of the things he does and the way he spins some of these lines. Like the one about, you know, I told you my real age is just one of my favorite moments in the film. But I think, you know, overall, I think when I saw it again, and I really not seen it in many years until we started this process last year, the thing that really stuck out for me was Alexis's performance. And really, I guess just sort of how I just always thought Alexis was a great actor. And I feel like when you're making a movie with somebody and you become so enmeshed in the process, it's hard to kind of step back and see what you've done sometimes. And watching it now from 25 years later, I was like, Alexis gives such an amazing performance in this film. It's really sweet. He's sort of the center, the soft kind of center of the movie in a way. So he's not like the craziest character in this group of, you know, actors who are being very like funny and wacky, but he really kind of holds the movie down and is sort of its emotional heart. And that really just struck me when I watched it again. And part of that is probably because he's not here anymore. You know, it sort of makes me a little sad about that too, that he's not around. But I just really was impressed by his performance. You know, it just really made me happy to see that.
And there are shots of him where he's so beautiful, the mouth and like, oh, yeah, yeah, just lovely. Did you stay in touch with Alexis after the movie much, or had you been in touch
I would over see the years? I would see him out and about when I was in LA, like often kind of on the nightlife scene, because he was often performing or hosting clubs and events. So I definitely would see him out and about here and there. But in the last, you know, the later years of his life, I had not seen him in a while. And it was really sad to, you know, have him pass away at such a young age. I mean, he was in his 40s still, so it's kind of shocking.
Well, it's another reason why it's nice to look back at this movie, because his talent really comes through in it. What does the restoration involve? Like, what did that mean for you in terms of what you were doing?
Well, we had to go back to like the original negative of the film. We tried to find, you know, often like when you're trying to get a film onto digital, we had to get it into an HD digital format for it to be released on streaming, because the streamers won't take like a video transfer done in the 90s, basically.
Oh, so there's no streaming future unless you do this.
Yeah, yeah. Really, you need to have like a good quality, like digital copy of your film now to get it out into the world, which has become a problem. There's a lot of films from that era, especially indie films, where, you know, they've fallen out of distribution because they don't have this kind of like high res digital version that's the standard for streaming now.
Right.
So yeah, we kind of really had to go back to the beginning. We had to go back to the negative, rescan the negative, find the sound, put the sound together. It was a process. It definitely took a little longer than I thought it would. But, you know, I feel like anytime you're doing anything with a film, it always takes a little longer than you think it will. But yeah, so it was really, and we got to, you know, really make the film look great. I remember the first video transfer we did back in the 90s, we, you know, it was kind of the end of the process of making the film. So we had, you know, basically run out of money. There was not a lot of time to spend doing like the color correct for the video. So it was never like great. So this time I felt we had a chance to kind of redo a lot of that. And I think the new version of the film just looks beautiful. It just really, we shot it on 35mm, and now you can really kind of see that kind of glory of shooting something on 35. It just looks really great. And yeah, the new color correct is just so nice to see that.
Last year was the 25th anniversary of my book, Misadventures in the 213. And I thought of trying to do something with it. I still might. I guess my point is, I think for a lot of my peers, things that we did back then, I'm a little surprised about how meaningful they are now, or how, like, if somebody said, hey, will you go do something related to that and here's a little bit of a check, I would do it in a heartbeat. Like, I guess I thought, I don't know, all these other things were going to come after, and maybe it's like, no, it's that thing you did. I just got back from Palm Springs where we hosted the Mismatch Game, this show that I've been doing at the Gay and Lesbian Center for 20 years. Yeah, I'm still doing it, and I'm glad to be doing it. Any thoughts about my my realization of like, oh, it wasn't just going to go up and up and up. You're going to really be appreciative of those things that seem to have connected along the way and mean something to people, and you're going to squeeze them dry. I'm speaking for myself, but it's not just me. I noticed it around, like a lot of other people that we all were part of that same sort of generation of creating things that were gay at a time when not a lot of stuff was able to get made. Like you had to kind of, it was a big deal to get something out there. And
what I realized, you know, the film had fallen out of distribution a few years ago. I don't remember exactly when, but it was at least, you know, 5 or 6 years ago. But And I kind of knew that, but I was also kind of like, well, I don't know. It's going to be difficult to kind of get it back into distribution. But there was an Instagram account called Gay Cinema Archive. I don't know if you follow them.
No, or, but I'm going to now.
They're called Queer Cinema Archive. That's the exact right. name. And their, you know, mission is kind of highlighting queer films from the entire 20th century, basically, like films that people might not know about. And they did a couple series of posts about I Think I Do, and they really kind of like blew up. Like, I was really surprised how much, you know, in the comments where people are like, I want to see this. I saw this in the 90s. It really meant a lot to me then. I'd love to see it again. And I was sort of like, oh, you know, I guess maybe there is, you know, sort of, you know, a desire for people to see these things because they did mean a lot at that time. Like you said, there were not a lot of these movies out there. There wasn't a TV show you could watch about gay people at the time. I mean, it was right before Will and Grace started airing. But these things were really unique, and they were also kind of very communal events. I just remember a lot of people telling me they would go with a group of friends, you know, to see this at the movie theater. And that was sort of a unique experience to go see like a gay rom-com with all of your best friends. And I've also heard of stories of people who went on first dates and a couple people who actually got married, you know, based on people that they, you know, went on first dates with to this movie, kept dating, and then they eventually got married. So I think that is sort of meaningful, you know, too, that the film really, you know, this movie was like a date movie for people. And I think that's amazing.
What do you remember about the time that it came out? Were you nervous about it? Were you tracking the box office? Did you feel pressure, or was it just really fun to do screenings and be part of the release?
I was definitely, you know, nervous about it because when you're doing an indie film and you're putting it out into the world, you don't have a big budget for marketing. You can't do TV commercials. So it really depends upon word of mouth, you know, and it depends on the reviews too. So I think I was most nervous about what the New York Times review was going to be like, because that was always a big indicator for indie films about, you know, whether it was going to be a success or a failure, you know, right. What the Times would say that would go on your ad. And also that's something, you know, the quote unquote chattering class would talk about, like, oh, this movie got a great review, let's go see that, you know? So I do remember being very nervous about the review, and there was all this like strategizing, like who's going to review it? Like, how are they going to get her to the theater? And, you know, I remember somebody said like, oh, well, she had a glass of wine before, so that's really good. You know,
like, you're practically like stalking the reviewer. It's like waiting for Guffman almost.
Yeah. All these like details. And I'm just like, just let me know when the review is out. And the review came out and it was very, very good. It definitely was a really positive review. And once that happened, then, you know, it was really an amazing experience kind of having the film get out there and seeing. We ran in New York at the Quad Theater for almost, I think, a little over 3 months, actually, which was a really long time for
That's
a film.
Amazing to run in a theater for 3 months. That's incredible.
Yeah, because we were running still. We opened in the beginning of April, and it was still running there during Pride. So it was really a great run. And it played, I think, at like 50 other cities around the U.S. and had some pretty decent runs around the country, too. And then it got released in the U.K. and it got released in Europe. So the film really did, you know, kind of connect with audiences. You know, I think if we had a bigger budget and had the ability to like market it and, you know, make TV commercials, it could have like crossed over to a mainstream audience, but we just didn't have the ability to do that as an indie film. Cause that was always my idea, was to kind of make this film that's a film for both gay and straight audiences. They can both, you know, enjoy it. You can bring your mom to see the movie.
Yeah.
As I did.
Your mom, yeah, and the smoking was her big holdup issue.
And smoking was her only problem, yeah.
And Marnie Nixon is in the movie, and I saw the name, I was like, am I saying it right? Marnie Nixon?
Yeah.
Okay, and Marnie, I was like, wasn't she famous for being the voice of people that other, like, famous stars in musicals? Am I thinking of the right person?
Yeah, she was the voice in West Side Story for Natalie Wood, and then she was the voice for Audrey Hepburn in My Fair Lady, I believe, as well. And she also was in Sound of Music herself. She was one of the nuns. She was Sister Sophia in Sound of Music. But yeah, it was really
incredible. How did she come to be in your movie?
Well, that part was, you know, we were really trying to get a lot of different people for that role. We had to get Elaine Stritch at one point, and Elaine Stritch was her own agent. And
of course she was.
Yeah, of course she was. And so the producer like called and talked to her, and then he came into the casting room. He's like, "Hey, do you know somebody named Elaine Stritch?" And I'm like, "Yes." He's like, "Well, she can't do it." I'm like, "What do you mean she can't do it?" He's like, "She wants too much money." I'm like, "Wait, you were negotiating with Elaine Stritch on the phone?" He's like, "Yeah, she's crazy." I'm like, "Oh, okay.
All right, that's so good."
Yeah, yeah. So we were really kind of trying to get like sort of a big, you know, name to kind of like get some attention. And, but a lot of those bigger names wanted a lot of money too. Yeah. So, Marnie was very great. Marnie was so game to do this. She was totally down for the indie experience, which I thought was incredible. And she was so fun to work with. She just was just great. I mean, her attitude, you know, it's sort of like what you want in, you know, somebody doing this kind of thing. They're there to have fun. One of the funniest things about this role, too, is Jessica Walter read the part for a stage reading we did from Arrested Development. Yeah. And she was really great playing that part. But, yeah, you know, when it came to the stage reading, she just was complaining the whole time, like at the stage reading, like, "It's too hot. I need, you know, another glass of water. Like, my chair is like in the wrong place." You know, it was just like 100 complaints. So when we started casting, you know, we were like, "Yeah, we can't do complainer."
There's my friend has a thing called the Life's Too Short list. And he's like, "I think she's now on my Life's Too Short list." I'm not saying you're saying that about her, but it just reminded me of that. Let's talk about the music in the movie. You got a Matthew Sweet song, which is such a 90s thing, right? Your opening. Yeah. Was that very expensive?
90s. It was pretty expensive.
I love that song.
Yeah, I really love that song too.
What's the name of it? Remind me.
Sick of Myself.
Yeah. Sick of Myself. Yeah.
We initially wanted a song by the B-52s, actually. I remember in one of the cuts, it was a B-52 song. I think it was Rome, maybe.
Right on.
But that was a little pricey. You know, yeah. B-52s were definitely above Matthew Sweet. But, you know, then in the end, I liked Sick of Myself. It was a bit kickier, and it was a bit more of the moment, you know, as well. Like, it just felt very current of that era.
And it ages so well. I heard that song and I was like, "Oh," it just made me feel something. And also, I'm obsessed with the Partridge Family. I've loved them ever since I was a kid. I wanted to be Chris Partridge. I would sleep with my hair flipped up in the back in the hopes that I would wake up with a Chris Partridge flip in the next day, the blonde, not the original Chris. Although I love them both. Talk to me about your choice to use the Partridge Family music multiple times, like throughout, and how awesome they are.
Well, I also wanted to be Chris Partridge as well.
Right on.
With the flip.
Yep.
Not original Chris, because I was, you know, blonder as a kid. So yeah. I was like, "Oh, yeah, this works. I can just like fill in for him or something, you know, like it'll be great."
on the drum kit.
Yeah. So, how the Partridge Family came into this, I was working on a draft of the script out on Fire Island, I think. And an ex of mine was writing for People magazine, and he was doing like a story on Keith Partridge, I think, or David Cassidy.
Right.
And he was playing a lot of the music in the house, and I was just hearing a lot of the music, and I had forgotten about, I mean, I knew about I think I Love You. That, you know, was sort of their number one big hit.
Right.
I forgot about all the other songs too, and like so many other great songs that they did, like, were just wonderful, you know, like Only a Moment Ago is like one of my favorites that's featured in the movie. And so I was like, "Oh, it'd be just great to really, you know, make that kind of the soundtrack of the film."
They're your Simon and Garfunkel for The Graduate, except it's the Partridge Family in your movie.
Yeah. And it was sort of at that time too, in the mid 90s, that was sort of a theme in indie films. Like, there was that movie, from the UK, which was using a lot of the, Mamas and the Papas songs.
Oh, right. Oh, make your own kind of music. Beautiful thing. Yes.
Yeah. So there was, and you know, there was the Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, which was all ABBA songs. So there was this kind of moment of like picking a nostalgic band and then like making that your soundtrack. So, but it did sort of come out, you know, through Kismet, because I just had forgotten about a lot of that music and how much I loved it too. Like I really, you know, grew up with that music and just it really holds a special place for me. So it was fun to kind of put that back in there.
Was it easy to get the rights? Were they pricey or how did it work out? They were the like, wait, you want to put this in a movie? Here you go.
Yeah. The rights were very, very difficult. First of all, the movie was originally called, our original title for the film was I Think I Love You.
Right.
And that, of course, was a rights problem because you can't use the song and then use the title. That's an additional like $50,000 or $100,000, I think.
Wow.
To that, to make the title yours, you know, to make the title song your song, or sorry, to make that song your title is an extra fee.
Wow.
I could have called the movie I Think I Love You if I included no Partridge Family songs at all. Like, you can't copyright a title.
Right.
But then put that song in your movie, and then you call your movie that, that's when it gets really, really expensive. So first thing we had to do was change the title to I Think I Do, which, you know, ended up working out pretty well. I do really like that title now as well. But then it was like a two... I think it was almost a 2-year process really negotiating the rights. The biggest issue at the time was the Brady Bunch movie had happened.
Right.
And so I believe Paramount owned the Partridge Family and they were trying to develop a Partridge Family movie. And so they were really kind of holding onto the songs for that. And they were kind of like reluctant to give up the songs. And you know, they didn't want it to compete with the Partridge Family. Not that we would be competing with a Partridge Family movie, but, you know, it's such a different level of film. So eventually that movie obviously never happened. And then we, you know, I feel like the thing with music rights that I've learned is if you just keep knocking down their door, they'll eventually, you know, give up and like, you know, give you the rights. You do have to pay, you know, a good amount of money for them, but it's just a long process. And we had to... We made a direct appeal to the songwriter too, because he was gay. The guy who wrote, like, I Think I Love You. I'm trying to remember.
Oh, I didn't know that. I don't know nothing about the songwriters.
Yeah, yeah. He, I think his name is Tony something. I'd have to look it up again. So, you know, through some friends, we made an appeal to him. And I think we made an appeal to David Cassidy through my friend at People Magazine. You know, you kind of have to just keep trying to like get the personal angle in there somehow and just be persistent. But we did get them in the end. And we had, you know, we got to use all these songs in the movie, which was great. But we had limited rights. Like we couldn't use them in the trailer. We couldn't use them in advertising. Not that we were going to be doing, you know, TV ads during Thursday Night Friends or something. But we definitely, you know, got the rights because we had a very limited use of the rights as well.
Did you ever hear from any of them after the movie came out or anything?
From
David Cassidy, Shirley Jones.
Oh, you know.
Your Bonaducci, your Susan Crowe. Your Brian Forrester, your Susan Day.
No, that would have been really nice. I wonder if they ever, you know, saw the movie.
Yeah.
But no, we didn't hear anything back. But that would have been nice to know if they had actually got a chance to see it.
Yeah. Favorite Partridge Family album? I think mine might be Up to Date or Shopping Bag. Because they used to name their albums after whatever you got for free. Like if there was a shopping bag in it, that was Shopping Bag.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Up to Date was like a calendar. And I still know that David Cassidy's birthday is April 12th because it's right there on the calendar.
Oh, Up to Date is my favorite Partridge album. And I actually have it framed on my wall in the hallway.
Oh, that is hardcore. Is that the one is I'll Meet You Halfway on that way one? Or is that maybe on Shopping Bag?
I think I'll Meet You Halfway is on Up to Date, if I'm remembering
it's
right.
It's so pretty. It's such a pretty song. Do you know the monologue from Doesn't Somebody Want to Be Wanted?
Oh, no, I don't.
I do, and I could do it. Yeah, I'm going to do it right now.
Oh, my God.
Let me think for a second. Okay, here we go. You know, I'm no different from anybody else. I start each day, and I end each night. But it gets pretty lonely when you're by yourself. Now, where is love? And who is love? I gotta know. Doesn't somebody?
Oh, then my it goes God. Back in.
Yeah.
That's incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, it's just
stuck
in my brain.
You're more hardcore than me, I think.
I'm pretty hardcore, but I remember when I first saw it, I was like, yes, that's so inspired. I just thought it was inspired. And I loved seeing it again in that way. I have some random movie questions that I like to ask movie people that make movies and see if any of these jump out at you. What movie did you see when you were too young to see it?
Oh, my gosh. I think my parents were really strict about movies when I was growing up. Like, I couldn't see PG movies unless they came with me or unless they had seen it and could give me the guidance before I went to see it. So, and this was up until I was in high school. So I was really restricted on what I could see in a lot of ways. But the one I definitely remember seeing that I was too young to see was Porky's.
with the thing through the wall. It was all about the
yes,
grabbing. Yes.
Porky's, oh my God. Porky's was the gayest like high school comedy and the dirtiest. I mean, it was so like hard R. Like it was a serious hard R. And lots of male butts in it. And I remember the only reason I went to see it was my parents were out of town. So I was like, okay, because my friends were like, we're going to go see Porky's. We're going to sneak in. And I'm like, all right, I'll do it. My parents are out of town. I think I can get away with it.
the great sneaky Porky's run. I love it. Here's another movie-related question. What movie have you seen more than any other?
Oh, my gosh. Well, I think it's probably a tie between Auntie Mame and Clueless.
Interesting double feature.
Yeah.
Why do you love them both? What do you love about Auntie Mame?
Auntie Mame, I mean, I love Rosalind Russell. She's just so incredible in that part. And it's just so campy, the outfits and the whole scenario of that movie. That movie used to be on PBS like every year. Like they would show it at the same time every year. I feel like it was maybe around Easter, actually. And I would watch it with my younger brother, and we just always like cracked up and just were always quoting it back to each other when we were growing up. So yeah, it's like a highly quotable movie. I feel like that's the key to me for the repeat watching. And I feel like Clueless is the same way, like so many great quotable lines in that movie that I feel like I still say every now and then. So I feel like that's probably where they cross-pollinate. The writing in both those movies is so smart and so funny and so, you know, in a way, timeless. I mean, both those movies now, Clueless is what? Like, that's got to be 25 years old.
Yeah.
And Auntie Mame is like, you know, 60 years old, and you can still watch those movies and just crack up. I just find them so entertaining.
They definitely both hold up. I went to a screening of Clueless right after the pandemic, and I think Susan Seidelman like zoomed in, and it was just so exciting. It was one of the first times any of us were out in the world.
Oh wow!
Yeah, it was a magic time. You're doing some live events, right, to go with the re-release of I Think I Do. Is that right?
Yeah, we're doing a kind of like world premiere screening of our new version of the film. The 4K version is going to screen at Newfest as part of their Queering the Canon series, which happens every spring. They put together a little mini festival of films from, you know, the 70s, 80s, 90s that are kind of, you know, now kind of like considered queer classics. And so we were very honored to be part of that group this year. And so we're screening at BAM Rose Cinemas on April 15th. That'll be the world premiere. And we're having a little cast reunion, too, for that screening as well. We're going to have most of our cast there in attendance. And that should be really fun, too.
That's going to be amazing to get them all together and be there and all of that.
Yeah.
Going back to when the movie came out, what do you remember about the time afterwards? Was it one of those periods of, like, all this activity, and then it's like, oh, shit, now what? Like, what was it like after the high of it?
Well, I think the big thing, you know, was trying to get the next project done. And that was sort of, you know, what I was working on for a few years after the movie came out. I was working on a high school comedy, actually, which was sort of inspired a little bit by Clueless. But it was sort of my own, you know, take on a high school comedy, which was about three guys who were in their 30s who kind of get magically taken back to high school by like a spell that's gone wrong.
It happens all the time. Yeah.
And they end up as gay men trapped in teen girl bodies in high school in the 90s. So, and the movie was called Sluts. And
I want to see Sluts.
I know. Yeah. We were really, you know, trying to get this made for a few years. And it was just a little, yeah, it was a little too out there, I think, for that time. It was sort of like, you know, we were trying to do like a much bigger movie, you know, not do this as an indie, but really do it as a studio, kind of a slightly raunchy kind of like, you know, teen comedy. But yeah, it just we made a lot of efforts and we got a lot of interested people. We had a lot of actresses attached who are now very famous, but did not help back then when they were not famous. So yeah, that's sort of what I was working on a lot in that period after, which was really, you know, fun and exciting. And then I was kind of doing other things here in New York too, working on other films and other, you know, film projects. So yeah, it was a busy time, definitely.
I think creative careers go through their sort of ups and downs and stuff like that. What sort of keeps you going? What sort of got you through your sort of down parts? Because I think dealing with that is a bigger part of the business almost than the creative part.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, I think what keeps me going is just I still really like kind of finding and telling original, interesting stories. You know, I still love going to the movies and I really love watching great, you know, engaging TV shows. And I really, you know, it's the sort of desire to kind of like contribute more of those types of shows and those types of movies to the culture. Cause I love telling stories. And if there's a chance that I can do that, I'll keep pushing towards making that chance happen. Cause that's really what I love doing.
I love it. Apart from the screening, that's part of Newfest, how can people see I Think I Do once it's released out into the world?
It'll be at Newfest April 15th. That's just one kind of screening, but then it'll be on streaming just a few days after that. April 19th is when you can get it on Amazon or Apple TV.
How exciting. You're part of the streaming. Yeah.
The streaming verse.
Yeah, the streaming verse. We didn't even know that was a thing back then.
I know. It's kind of amazing, you know, that, you know, as much as like streaming is kind of taken away from movies being kind of special, the great thing is that it does, you know, give people the chance to see movies like this, you know, instantly, like in their home, which, you know, I could have not have even imagined kind of back then when the film was made that it would be able to have like an instant audience of, you know, people all over the United States and essentially all over the world too, depending on what platform you're on. It's really kind of remarkable that people, you know, can have access to this, these kind of films. And that to me is just wonderful.
Wrapping it up, there's something I often ask people when a project is new. I will say, you know, imagine it's 30 years from now. What's a memory from making this that you will always remember, that will never, you know, fade? So for you, what's a memory of making that movie that has stuck with you?
Oh, wow. There are so many memories. It's kind of like, you know, when I watch the movie now, it's almost like watching a photo album, you know, in real life. You kind of see the scenes and then I'm kind of remembering that day and like what happened that day and like getting to the set and, you know, things going on. Like we definitely, you know, had challenges as an independent film. But I think one of the funniest stories, I guess, for me as a filmmaker is the first day I arrived on set. We were shooting the hotel scenes and we were shooting at a hotel in New Jersey and we were driving up to the hotel and I saw all these trucks parked in front of the hotel. And I'm like, oh, I guess maybe there's a convention happening at the hotel today or something. Like, that's kind of weird. And then the AD is in the car and the AD is like, oh, no, those are our trucks. And I'm like, oh, those are ours? Like, that's us?
Right.
And I was kind of like, oh, I didn't have to like drive the truck to the set. I didn't have to like bring the light in from the truck. You know, I was so used to the film school kind of DIY mentality that
right.
My first day on a real set was just kind of like this wonderland. Like I walked in, there was a craft service table set up with donuts that I did not buy.
yeah.
And I remember actually also on the set that day being chastised nicely by the AD because I was trying to move some lights between one of the setups. And she's like, don't touch the equipment. Like, people don't like it when you touch their equipment. It's really not a nice thing to do, even though you're trying to be helpful. And I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot. Sorry. This is like a totally different way of working than I was used to. So that to me is one of the, you know, funnier, you know, cute memories, I guess. Because I was just in a state of wonder. I was like, wow, this is incredible. Like, we have a lot of stuff to make this movie. It's kind of great.
Yeah. I love that. I love that. You show up and you're like, oh, this is because of us. That's awesome. Well, Brian, it's been really fun to talk to you. I remember seeing this movie. I remember loving it. It was so fun to watch it again. You're keeping the Partridge family alive, which I appreciate. So everyone should watch this when it becomes available for them to see. And thank you for doing the podcast.
I'm excited. It's going to have a whole, you know, the audience of people who saw it back then, but also I'm excited, you know, for other people who haven't seen it, who think, you know, that Bros was the first gay romantic comedy. And I'm like, no, we've been doing this for a while.
Right. Exactly. It's been,
I love Bros. Bros was great, but I'm like, yeah, this has been a work in progress. We started, you know, trying to get this out in the '90s, and, you know, I'm really glad that movies this process has continued. Like, the gay characters are now just not in indie films. They're everywhere. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah. It's been quite a journey for, for people in that world. Awesome. Thank you so much, Brian. This has been really fun.
Oh, thanks, Dennis. It was great to see you and chat with you about the movie.
Thanks again to Brian Sloan. Check out I Think I Do. It comes to streaming on April 19th on Amazon and Apple. All right, so this happened. I just got back today from Palm Springs, where we did the mismatch game at Oscars downtown, and it was super fun. A fun audience, a rollicking cast. It was a really good time. And then this morning, before I drove back to LA with my friend Danny, I went to Drag Brunch at Oscars, hosted by Jackie Beat, who no one makes me laugh harder than Jackie Beat. Like, killing it with the comedy. Just laugh after laugh, singing live, rapping about how she likes Baby Got Front, like this whole song about big dicks. Killing me. Jackie Beat is a national treasure. There, I'm just going to say it. And I was also fascinated with the idea of drag brunch, because it was mostly straight people, I think, at this drag brunch. Lots of groups of women. And I know people are like, the bachelorette parties are ruining gay bars. I'm looking at the commerce, and there are a lot of groups of ladies together having a great time, tipping like crazy. You know, a drag queen will do a shablam, and out come the wallets and the money. And it was like just the whole idea of a drag brunch and who goes there. And we were sitting next to a table of older women in Palm Springs who were super nice, probably all in their 70s, just having a great time at drag brunch. And I guess, I don't know, I guess I'd have to ask these women what the appeal is, but I think having a fun time where there's no, they don't have to worry about straight guys hitting on them or anything like that. They're out with their gals. I don't know. It's a whole thing. And it was just kind of fun to observe the whole dynamic, but I had a great time. And I'm now a fan of drag brunch. I'm into it. The mimosas were flowing. The French toast was tasty. The drag queens were bringing it. Jackie was slaying with the comedy. I'm a big fan of the drag brunch phenomenon. All right, that's enough for this week. Thank you so much for listening. And I want to give a shout out to Oscar Rosario for mixing the episodes. My theme music is by Mark Daniels for Placement Music. We'll catch you next time on Dennis Anyone. Bye.